Hi, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point. Democrats scheduled another TV special this week with 10 presidential candidates on the same platform, allowed 90 seconds or sometimes less to answer complex policy questions. What matters most, the substance of what they say, their exchanges with one another, or the way they look on camera? Not on the stage, but the newest part of the mix, Deval Patrick, former governor of Massachusetts, who has registered for the New Hampshire primary. Also considering a last-minute entry and being talked about is the billionaire Mike Bloomberg, former mayor of New York. But the range of political options for Democratic voters already stretches from Sanders and Warren on the progressive left to Biden and Buttigieg and Klobuchar on the center right. Jenna Johnson is a national political correspondent for The Washington Post. And Jenna, welcome to our show.
Thank you for having me.
You went out and sampled some voters in Iowa very recently. Iowa caucuses, of course, being the first time that they'll actually have voters at the polls. Are they worried about the fact that so many candidates with so many different positions are still on the ballot?
Yeah. And when I talked with party leaders, they kept saying, you know, they can't remember a caucus when this many people were this undecided this far out. A colleague and I spent a bunch of time in Iowa going around and chatting with people. One of my colleagues talked with this retiree in her 70s at an event in Ames. And that woman told her that she was actually having nightmares about trying to decide who to caucus for. And unlike in previous years where when you're at town halls, you would hear people mostly just talking about, here's what's happening in my life, here's what's happening to my family, what can you do to help me? We're hearing a lot of caucus goers who almost sound like TV pundits. You know, they're asking, what are you going to do to appeal to this group of voters or that group of voters? Or, you know, just kind of getting back to this question of, are you electable or not? It's not so much about what they personally want, what they personally love. It's a lot of, just tell me who's going to get elected, who can beat Trump, and sure, I'll vote for that person.
So that's what Iowa voters are thinking about most.
Well, that's what some of the Iowa voters that we chatted with have been talking about.
I didn't mean to suggest that you did a scientific survey, because obviously you didn't.
Every single Iowan we have surveyed and can say exactly what they're thinking.
So what do you think they're looking for as the latest round of what it can only be called, it seems to me, reality TV is about to occur?
You know, that's a great question. And there's a lot of strategists who would love to know the exact answer to that question. It depends on who you talk to. You know, there are some people who are, you know, kind of leaning towards former Vice President Joe Biden. They feel like, you know, he's the sort of person who could maybe win back some of these white working class voters who moved to Donald Trump in 2016. And so when he's on the stage, they're looking to see if he can hold up or not. And if he kind of matches that ideal that they've set in their head. There's also other voters who are looking for someone who can inspire them. You know, a lot of people talk about when Obama was first running for office. You know, there's just this nostalgia for a candidate who can get people excited, who can get people out volunteering and giving money and really believing in a candidate. And supporters of, you know, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, Pete Buttigieg, and some of the other candidates say, you know, that's our candidate. You know, this is someone who can excite voters and get people excited. And I think a lot of voters, you know, maybe they're not quite happy with the people who've been leading in the polls, and they're willing to kind of keep looking. You know, they're in luck because there are many, many, many candidates for them to consider. And so the debate is really an opportunity for some of these lower polling candidates to really stand out. Amy Klobuchar, the senator from Minnesota, debates have been a great opportunity for her to really introduce herself to voters and kind of slowly gain in the pollings, gain in the fundraising. The same with Kamala Harris, Senator from California, also hoping that this debate can kind of, you know, kickstart a campaign that has been floundering. And for the other four candidates on the stage, Andrew Yang, Steyer, Gabbard, Booker, the four of them haven't qualified for the December debate yet. So this is really an opportunity for them to really kind of hopefully stay in the race.
You have raised a lot of really interesting issues. Will Biden hold up or not? Are the candidates sufficiently inspiring? Do certain candidates, Klobuchar on the one hand, Harris on the other, really need the debate in order to stay alive? And what about the also-rans? We'll touch on all of those as we go along. But first, let's consider what it is that people respond to when they're watching the debates. Patrick Stewart is an associate professor of political science at the University of Arkansas, and he's author of Debatable Humor, Laughing Matters on the 2008 Presidential Primary Campaign. Looking back at a bit of history, Patrick Stewart, good to have you with us.
It's great to be here.
When you study the debates, whether it's the 2008 debate or others that have happened since then, in this format, with the brief questions and answers, the advertising that goes on in between, what is it, do you think, that viewers respond to the most?
Well, I think the thing is you want to have your candidates to be likable. But ultimately, when you've got 10 candidates on stage, it's about dominating attention, which means oftentimes belittling the other candidates and grabbing their time by interrupting. So it's difficult because when we look at our candidates, we oftentimes evaluate them based upon their competence. And then we look at their trustworthiness, whether or not we like them. But ultimately, it's about their charisma, their excitement that they can get from us. And that is based upon whether we laugh at them, at the jokes that they tell, whether they boo the people that they attack, whether we applaud them. So the audience themselves play a huge role in the response to the candidates and how we respond to them responding to the candidates.
We've heard the name Pete Buttigieg already. Here's an example of him in one of the recent debates.
Running because the decisions we make in the next 3 or 4 years are going to decide how the next 30 or 40 go. And when I get to the current age of the current president in the year 2055, I want to be able to look back on these years and say my generation delivered climate solutions, racial equality, and an end to endless war. Help me deliver that new generation to Washington before it's too late.
So, Patrick Stewart, not a thigh slapper, but a bit of humor there. Does that help Buttigieg, do you think, look nicer, look more interesting, look more inspiring?
Well, certainly it does. And one of the things that a colleague of mine, Casey Klofstad, does work on vocalics. And one of the things that we can hear with Pete Buttigieg is he's got a very deep voice, which gives him a resonance, a sense of dominance, so that when we listen to him, we take him more seriously. And I think that's one of the things that really matters, especially with these debates when you're trying to stand out. And so he's done an excellent job with this message and also differentiating himself from those older candidates, especially the older male candidates.
What about the women? Their voices traditionally are not regarded as dominant, and they certainly aren't low and resonant.
Well, I think that they certainly get lower as with age, and I think that's one of the characteristics that we see with some of the older female candidates. Elizabeth Warren brings a great deal of wisdom with her. And I think that's maybe one of the things that makes her one of those candidates that's at center stage. But females being so powerful and so important in this electoral cycle is something that's new to what we've seen previously. And it's a part of the Me Too movement, which is in itself a direct response, arguably, to Donald Trump and all that has followed.
Let me go quickly back to Jenna Johnson with the Washington Post, who toured the state of Iowa and talked on a non-scientific basis to a lot of people. What about the issue of gender in this presidential race? Did you find that it plays a role?
You know, surprisingly, we're not finding it play much of a role at all, which is so surprising, given that it played such a big role in the 2016 election when Hillary Clinton was running, and has played a big role in a lot of congressional races with voters very eager to vote for female candidates. That's not to say I haven't met a number of voters who would love to see a woman in the White House. But it's something about this cycle, and maybe it's just that we have so many candidates and so many female candidates, that I really don't hear voters talking about that much.
Back to Patrick Stewart. What about the fact that we have what I referred to earlier, and I think everybody agrees that this is what it is, a reality TV performance rather than a lengthy substantive exchange of views on very, very complicated issues? How helpful is it to potential voters when everybody gets a little time, and when the issue, as you indicated, is trying to interrupt each other, dominate, belittle, and basically conduct a performance?
Yeah, I agree with you in that the current debates, as they're set up with 10 people on stage, or with the Republicans where they had 10 people at the beginning, it benefits those who already have a pre-built-in audience that like them. And it's something where you have to grab attention by insulting people, by aggressing on them somehow, by interrupting. And it's really, I think it's maybe time that we reconsider how we sift through all these candidates at the very beginning. I would almost say that, you know, arguably, if we're going to do reality TV, which this is a game show to a certain extent, we might as well make it like Survivor and see what is the suite of leadership skills that we need from our candidates. It's not just about dominating. It's oftentimes about bringing people together and leading them through difficult issues. And if there are a way to get at that, to get at the trustworthiness, the warmth, the characteristics that maybe we don't see as often in our candidates at the national level because they have to be fit this characteristics that are expected from dominant males who are defending a group against outsiders, we might end up with better candidates or who are more capable of responding to all the issues that we're dealing with these days.
Patrick Stewart at the University of Arkansas. Let me introduce Elaine K. Mark, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, lecturer in public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, and a member of the Democratic National Committee and the DNC's Rules Committee since 1997. Great to have you back on our program.
Well, thanks for having me.
How the hell did we get to this situation?
Well, I think we got to this situation for a variety of reasons. First of all, there's a different generation that thinks it's their time to take over leadership of the party. So we see a huge age range in the candidates on the Democratic stage. The system is also very much wide open. Ever since 1976, when Jimmy Carter came out of nowhere to win the Iowa caucuses, people have decided to run for president because they think lightning might strike and they just might win. And ever since the 21st century and the innovation of primary national debates, we get people deciding to run for president who in another era would have never run for president or never been considered running for president, whether that's a pizza entrepreneur or a spiritual guru. We're in a new era. We're in a new era where people think, oh, I just might get lucky, might as well do it.
But let me ask you this, as a member of the Rules Committee, I understand what you're saying, but why put them all together at the same time and basically allow the cable news networks to determine the format and seldom give anybody enough of an opportunity to really say what they think?
Well, first of all, there's just too many people, and the party is fighting the last war where the party leadership 4 years ago came under a lot of criticism for the perception that they were favoring Hillary Clinton over Bernie Sanders. So this time, the party went way in the other direction to being perfectly neutral, letting anybody with a very small amount of support onto the debate stage. And once you do that, you have to have not much time for anybody. So it's basically the candidates have introduced themselves to the public, but they can't really do much more.
Well, the amount of support, I see. Was that a mistake? Did they allow the amount of support required to qualify?
Well, I mean, that may be looked on in retrospect as a mistake. The threshold was simply too low.
Did the same thing.
And what that allows for, when the thresholds are too low, it allows for people who really don't have any business running for president, but have some other reason that they're popular, like they've sold a lot of books. You can imagine movie stars. You can imagine country and western singers. You can imagine all sorts of people who the public knows and likes somehow qualifying to be on the stage with United States senators and a former vice president and people who have some claim to actually being able to be president. And I think this is a problem that both the Democrats and the Republicans are going to have to confront in the next cycle.
Let me introduce our final guest for this program, who's sitting with me in the studio at KCRW Radio in Santa Monica, Jamil Smith. He's a senior writer at Rolling Stone. Great to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me back.
Very interested in your take, coming from Rolling Stone, a relatively liberal leftist organization, on what we have heard so far. And what do you think particularly about this idea that what we need is an inspiring candidate? The name of Barack Obama invariably comes up in that context, and we don't have anybody that comes even close to what he did in terms of inspiring people.
Well, I think that, Warren, you got to be guarded against the notion of the savior. You know, there's a very distinct need, or I guess promoted need, for one person to come and save us from Donald Trump, save us from another 4 years. And it, rather than having the real contest of ideas that we really should be having, especially with this many candidates, we've been, you know, essentially weeding people out, seeing, well, can they beat Donald Trump? Well, none of us can tell the future. None of us are clairvoyant. So it's really kind of a false question to ask, and a false expectation to have of candidates. We have a really nuanced policy debate going on several levels with regards to criminal justice, environment, healthcare, a number of different topics. And unfortunately, I don't feel like the public is truly engaging with that. They're too scared of another 4 years of the current president.
When you say there's a debate going on these very serious issues, criminal justice, healthcare, and the environment, the only one we've really heard about at any length is healthcare.
Yes. And that's exactly what I expect in the debate. I expect Elizabeth Warren's Medicare for All proposal to be pretty much the headliner of the debate. And unfortunately, the way that these debates have been allowed to be moderated or structured, we've seen half hour debates on one topic. And then we see little bits about other things that are actually quite important. And a lot of things get missed. A lot of things don't get mentioned. We went a couple debates without abortion really getting any kind of substantive discussion. We get a little bits about criminal justice here and there. But, you know, Elizabeth Warren has a brand new policy about white nationalist violence. Are we going to see a lot that discussed in Atlanta? I seriously doubt that we're going to see half an hour or even, you know, maybe 3 minutes devoted to, weeding out this proposal.
Alain Kmark, back to you once again as a member of the Democratic National Committee Rules Committee. What's the relationship between the party and the moderators? And is there any effort to get the moderators to ask questions about subjects that are important, such as criminal justice, such as climate change, so that they don't have such as abortion, for example, so that they don't have again and again and again, which they have been doing, the same old debate on the same subject?
Well, look, I mean, yes, there is obviously the desire to cover the waterfront, including, by the way, foreign policy and military affairs, which are much more the job of the president than, frankly, any of the topics you just mentioned.
Sure.
But look, here's what happens. In a primary, and this is the same for the Republicans as well, in a primary, most of the candidates mostly agree on most of the issues. The differences between the candidates are actually fairly small in the scheme of things in a presidential primary. And it happens that this year, one of the biggest differences is to how to go about the future of healthcare in America. And there, because of Bernie Sanders' proposal and Elizabeth Warren's support of it, you actually have a fairly big and consequential difference. Unfortunately, because that's where the difference is, that has really gotten all the attention in the debates. And that really is too bad, because other issues, as Janiel said, other issues are just not getting the attention that they deserve. But there's a reason for that. There aren't actually that big a differences between the candidates on other proposals. And so it's in the nature of the beast. This will happen any time you have a primary debate, because whether it's Republicans or Democrats, generally people running for the nomination of their party don't have enormous policy differences.
Jamil Smith, Elizabeth Warren, yes, did embrace the Bernie Sanders proposal, but then she got a lot of heat because he has said, and she has sort of agreed, that private health insurance will be eliminated if his plan goes into effect. Now she's kind of backing away from that and saying, that won't happen for another 3 years. You'll be able to have your policy if you still like it. Does that make it inevitable that we're going to hear this one again and again when the new debate begins?
Oh, certainly. I think that that's going to be one of the focus, one of the focuses of, you know, her critics that are going to be on the stage with her are going to say, well, you said this thing, now you say this thing, which do you actually mean? You know, keeping in mind that they have their own contradictions. But I think, you know, with specifically, you have 3 years waiting for this. I'm wondering what she's thinking on this, because the idea that she would have, if she were elected president, the political capital to go forward with a proposal this massive, this substantive, in her third year, when essentially she's going to be running for president again. I find that to be a very curious proposal, and I wonder why it wasn't a part of the original idea.
That's Jamil Smith with Rolling Stone magazine. We're going to take a very brief break. We'll be right back with To the Point.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
We're only back with To the Point, talking today about the Democrats. Back to Jenna Johnson, again, our national political correspondent for The Washington Post. When you were in Iowa and when you met people that were, at least in one case, having nightmares about trying to make a decision and find somebody who could actually defeat President Trump, will there, do you think, be interest in Deval Patrick? Will there be interest in the former mayor of New York, if in fact he does actually register and get into it? Will they welcome more opportunities to make choices?
You know, who knows? I think the election of Donald Trump has taught political reporters to be careful about writing anyone off or making any predictions of any sort. But I would just say, in general, you know, voters I've spoken with in Iowa, in Wisconsin, in Georgia, in a number of states across the country, they're fine with the field they have. And frankly, they think it's much too large. The number one thing that I keep hearing from people again and again is they're kind of afraid to fall in love with a candidate because that person might drop out. I spent several months covering Beto O'Rourke, the former congressman from El Paso, Texas. You know, and there's a lot of people who really believed in him, and he really was not able to get any traction at all. His team partly thinks it's because it's just such a crowded field this year, and he's out. And when I was chatting with some of his supporters as he announced that he was dropping out, they were debating if they wanted to go into this big dinner that was happening in Iowa that night. And, you know, this one woman was saying, you know, I'm just going to pick someone else and then they're going to drop out too. I think that there is an eagerness from many voters to have a smaller field to pick from. And while there has been some chatter among major donors and the big minds in the Democratic Party that perhaps the field needs to be even bigger, I have yet to hear that sentiment from any of the voters I've spoken with.
Elaine K. Mark, anybody on the Democratic National Committee wants to see more people rather than than what we've
got? No, people don't want to see more people. And look, there's a certain familiarity to the period of time we're in, where everybody who's been running for 6 months to a year, we've all discovered that they have feet of clay. There's something wrong with absolutely everybody. So people are kind of looking around for the knight in shining armor to come in and sweep everybody away and take us out from the realm of mere mortals. The problem is there is no knight in shining armor. Certainly, the Mayor Bloomberg was a very good mayor of New York, but there's a lot of downsides there. And certainly Deval Patrick was a very good governor of Massachusetts, but he's in it late and he doesn't have billions of dollars to use to catch up. So, you know, neither of them are really the sort of magic answer. I'm with Jenna. I think that, frankly, these early state voters, they take it very seriously. And I was struck by what Jenna started with, which is talking about how they're looking for electability. The reason is that they understand that they and the New Hampshire voters have a very privileged place in the American nomination system, which is the two parties have allowed them to go first. And so they are looking at these candidates in a very, very serious way, in a way that, frankly, the rest of the country is not looking at. And I think they're a little bit ahead of the rest of the country.
Jamil Smith, you also said you didn't think of Xavier was going to come down the pike. Now, what about Deval Patrick? He has signed up in New Hampshire, right next to Massachusetts, and the people in New Hampshire take it seriously that they, like the people in Iowa, have an early shot at determining who the nominee is going to be. Do you think that he can make a dent in New Hampshire? And if so, will that change the nature of the race?
Well, he certainly has familiarity on his side, being from a neighboring state, but I mean, when you look at Deval Patrick as a candidate, you have a guy who's a managing partner at Bain Capital.
Where Mitt Romney was once the managing partner.
Exactly. And then you have a history of him working to, you know, essentially undermine black middle class families. I mean, he helped a Republican billionaire who went on to found AmeriQuest. He then worked for AmeriQuest, got a $360,000 salary. And this company was known as, you know, perhaps the worst, you know, subprime lender that there was. And, you know, basically preying on the very communities that he now purports to help. And so I think he's got a lot of explaining to do to the Democratic electorate that is seeing black and Hispanic voters, come to the forefront perhaps more than ever.
So there's a lot of conversation to the effect that what he's really doing is trying to take votes away from Elizabeth Warren, particularly because, of course, he comes from the same state, and therefore make it more difficult for her on the left wing of the party to succeed. Do you think he's playing that kind of role, or does he really think he has a chance? I don't know if you know him, but
I don't know Mr. Patrick, but I think his candidacy is more comment on Joe Biden and Pete Buttigieg than it is on Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. I think there is a hunger, apparently, for a moderate who can actually win, you know, over Donald Trump. Apparently, people are convinced that we require a moderate in order to do this. And so, yes, he in part may be there, you know, to please the Wall Street class, Wall Street element of the Democratic Party that wants to see Elizabeth Warren go by the wayside. But I think when you have Joe Biden and Pete Buttigieg, who may have their pockets of support, but don't have what it takes perhaps to take it all the way, I think that folks are getting a little bit concerned, and that you see more moderates joining the race.
Joe Biden has been the one who, it seems to me, has suffered the most from the fact that there is so little time to respond to complex questions in this debate format. He says he's uncomfortable with it. He looks like he's uncomfortable with it. Recently, he did a town town hall with CNN, and a lot of people who watched the town hall said, wait a minute, he looks fine to me. Here's an excerpt from there.
Will the current impeachment process convince independents that the president has to be defeated next November, or could this backfire on the Democrats?
Well, you know, to answer the question, Professor, the simple answer is this. The House has no option. It has to enforce the Constitution. Whether or not it turns out to work or not work, or whether or not it turns out that he should or shouldn't be kicked out of office, on the face of it, there's a prima facie case that he's violated the Constitution of the United States of America.
There's a very articulate response. Patrick Stewart, do you think that Biden suffers in the debate format on TV?
Certainly does, because he's not able to articulate his answer completely. And he has a tendency to spin off into different directions, where if you have a free-flowing approach such as town halls, you can explore things in greater depth, and that allows for him to branch out into the various different intricacies of policy. I think one of the key things that we'll look at with Joe Biden is that if we're making our judgments based upon thin slice judgments of his facial characteristics, it looks like he's had some work done, and it can be a little bit disturbing on the visceral level in response to him. So that might be playing a role as well, especially as people are looking and making judgments solely on facial characteristics.
I was once on television and used to worry about the fact that people wouldn't be hearing what I said, but rather looking at what sort of tie I was wearing or whether I was wearing one or not or whatever. I didn't have any facial surgery done, but I can understand why he might be embarrassed by that. But you're saying that people really do observe those things and it makes a difference.
No, most certainly. Most of our brain is structured around the visual cortex. So we have to take that into account, that the people who look like their leaders are ones that we're going to automatically gravitate towards. And that in itself has proven to be a bit of a problem when we define leaders as those who are larger, have deeper voices, certainly that's another aspect, and have body language and facial displays that are more agonistic, more threat-related than anything else. And that's certainly the case when you have multiple candidates. And we saw it with Donald Trump. Donald Trump's nonverbal display behavior throughout the early debates and all the way through the debates with Hillary Clinton were very aggressive. He was playing the dominant leader throughout, and that's what resonated with Republicans because, and I think this is an echo of what both Elaine and Jenna said, is that Democrats fall in love, but Republicans fall in line, and they've fallen in line.
Elaine Kmark, are you and other Democrats worried about the ultimate confrontation with whoever gets nominated and Donald Trump, who is so adept at dominating the stage, as he demonstrated again and again and again during the Republican debates and then, of course, when he was on the stage with Hillary Clinton?
No, I don't think we're particularly worried. I mean, part of what happens in a presidential election is the presidential election is about the incumbent. And the debates don't really have the kind of impact that we attribute to them, particularly when you've got an incumbent president. I also think that we have seen the women in this presidential field, in this Democratic field, be very dominant and very aggressive. And all of them have been, even Kristen Gillibrand, who's already dropped out, have really been able to take it to the other men on the stage. So I have no doubt that they would be able to do that with Donald Trump. And I think Joe Biden offers a very interesting case, because I think Joe Biden is genteel, polite, and above the fray in a way that Donald Trump, as we know, he's a big bully and he comes out fighting, he swings, he insults people. His way of dealing with any attack is to sort of give a fifth grade insult back. I think that act may be wearing thin, and I think that the contrast to somebody who looks like what we think presidents should be or what they used to be actually could be quite powerful on a stage.
Patrick Stewart, do you think it's wearing thin?
Donald Trump's act?
Yeah.
I think it is for many Americans. I think the challenge is that the way that we choose our leaders and how someone actually functions as a leader is very different. And that is why I think debates are proving to be quite a problem with the selection process, especially when you're loading people on stage and we're basing our decisions on gut instincts and how they can act like a leader who will defend us, which is, you know, an automatic response. But it's not necessarily what we need out of a leader. I think that the Democrats have the opportunity to show what we need as a leader through the debates, but the structure of the debates matter, as does the audience that is there. Ultimately, it's the audience that decides. And if the audience is not reflective of the population, of the voters of the Democratic Party, then we might not be receiving the best feedback on these candidates.
You mean the audience in the auditorium where the debate is taking place?
Yes, very much so. If we look at Donald Trump, he really became the candidate during the first debate. And when I looked at the audience response, there was certainly booing, but the laughter and the applause was extensive and much more than any of the other candidates. And so that certainly played a role in him standing out immediately as opposed to being shucked by the wayside. And part of it was because is that stadium was packed with supporters of Donald Trump. Now, that second debate, which was held in front of the upper level Republicans at the Reagan Library, there was much less response to him, but still enough to make him a serious candidate. And the stage was already set for him where he had the momentum. So he's no longer just a stunt candidate, and he became the candidate. So I think ultimately paying attention to the audience really matters. I think that maybe we ought to consider that being an audience member should be like jury duty, that we should go through the roles of those people who voted in the primaries and invite them as opposed to giving out tickets who are the friends of the friends of the friends and stacking the audience, because it's, well, more democratic.
Jamil Smith, what's your take on that?
Well, I want to go back a little bit to what we were talking about with what a president should look like. And I think that we have focused a lot on that. And frankly, I think to some degree, Joe Biden is dependent upon that perception of, you know, this sort of older patrician president. This is the president that we were used to electing. The person we're used to voting for is an older white man. And so we have to take into account not just the parts about gender, but also race. I mean, Kamala Harris, yes, had a moment in an early debate, but, you know, we have to you take into account that, you know, if she raises her voice to a certain level, if she is, you know, uses certain phrases maybe that the white man could get away with, she is perceived differently than a Joe Biden or a Pete Buttigieg. So I think we, you know, should also factor in the perceptions of the people, not just in the arena, but in outside of the arena. We look at Iowa and New Hampshire, two of the whiter states in the union are going to be the ones really kind of making the call here. And we have to be considering how mannerisms and in gestures and all the other things play into that.
Very interesting that you mentioned Kamala Harris in that context, because, of course, the way that she originally made a splash in the debates was to attack Joe Biden. It had to do with his support for Republicans in the distant past who were supportive of school segregation. Why is it, do you think, that she now has seemed to plummet to the point where at the Democratic State Convention this weekend here in California, there were people who were saying that she better be careful because if she doesn't do pretty well in Iowa and New Hampshire and then does poorly in California, of all places, she's going to set herself up for an attack on her Senate seat here in the next election.
Well, I think that attack is probably coming no matter what. But I think that the calls for her to get out of the race may be a bit premature here. She does have a significant constituency. It may not be reflected in the polling, but I, you know, having reported on her, having profiled her, the appeal is there. But the thing is, you're looking at, again, Iowa, New Hampshire, you know, heavily white states, may not be her audience. And but at the same time, she's not polling well in South Carolina either. So what has happened, I don't think anybody really can tell. I think that, you know, you factor in, you know, the obvious. She's a black woman running for president of the United States. Inherently, that's going to make her unpopular with some people. But I think to some degree, I think there have been mistakes made with her campaign, particularly in the release of policies, in the rollout of policy, that frankly just can't be made at this level. And I think that maybe she gets another chance at it, you know, maybe she'll have a better team.
Janet Johnson, back to you. Again, you toured Iowa and talked to a lot of voters there. There are very few black voters in Iowa. There's a number of black candidates on the presidential ballot. Did any of them sound electable to the people that you talked to?
Well, there are black people in Iowa. There are Latinos. There are immigrants. It's a very small segment of the population. And, we don't typically see, you have to remember that the Iowa caucuses are not like a typical primary where people can go throughout the day and vote. The Iowa caucuses require people to come to one location and hang out there and publicly take stances.
At night in very cold weather.
Exactly. And it's a process that has been dominated by white voters. It's a process that can be very intimidating to voters who feel like they might not quite belong there. I will say that, across the spectrum in Iowa, you hear a lot of the same names. And typically, it's the names of the candidates who are polling really well. And people will often say, you know, I think Elizabeth Warren's my favorite, but, you know, I really like Julian Castro, but I don't think he has a shot. A lot of times, you know, you kind of see this tiering in how people say their favorites. And frankly, the top polling candidates right now are white. Sure, there is a gay man in there, and that's a form of diversity that we've seen a lot of voters in Iowa really embrace. There was an Iowa poll that came out recently that showed Pete Buttigieg leading in Iowa. I think one other thing to keep in mind about Iowa is that, while it is very white, there are very progressive pockets in the state. If you go to Des Moines, if you go to Iowa City, you hear a lot of voters there talking about the issues that you would hear voters talking about in Brooklyn or in any major city across the country. And among a lot of Democratic voters, there is a lot of sensitivity around issues of race right now, about our criminal justice system, about police brutality. And while those might not be issues that are dominating our debate stages, those are issues that I'm hearing from a lot of voters on, white voters and non-white voters, things that they see as major problems in our country and things that they want to see changed.
Jamil Smith, we talk a lot about the black vote. It's never been clear to me that the black vote was, in fact, a unified block that was all going to go in the same direction. But we do have black candidates running for president, and they're not getting a lot of support from black voters. They seem to be going much more for Joe Biden than anybody else.
Well, Joe Biden certainly has the name identification with a lot of black voters. He has the association with Barack Obama, which he has certainly played up. But also, I do think that to a large extent, you know, Cory Booker and Kamala Harris in particular have not connected with that community or in communities, plural, that in a way that, you know, say Obama did. Obama was the first. There's only going to be one first. And so now that we've had a black president, what effect does that have on the electorate when they see other people of color running? Well, it's the novelty is gone. The goal has been accomplished. And also, a lot of people don't think that we'd ever get a second. And so I'm going to throw my support behind somebody who I actually think can win because we have Donald Trump as the opponent. I think if Donald Trump were not the opponent, I think if it were maybe a more standard Republican, I think maybe their considerations might be a little bit different.
You've spent some time with Julian Castro. What is he trying to do? He's one who looks like he might not make it to pass this debate.
Well, I've spoken with his campaign. They intend to go forward. They intend to continue to highlight issues that they feel are important. And thus far, we've seen those issues be, you know, specific to communities of color in a way that I think, frankly, a lot of other candidates have not been as specific. We've seen Pete Buttigieg's Douglas plan. We've seen, Cory Booker come forward with a, you know, strong proposal on white nationalist violence that, you know, predated Warren's that was released on Tuesday. But also Castro has been the only person to date until Warren's plan to introduce specific proposals dealing with policing reform. Now, Warren, in her plan for, dealing with white nationalist violence, introduces a police reform proposal within that, which I think it sends quite the message within a proposal to handle white nationalist violence from both a legal and a cultural standpoint. You would include police reform and also reform for the military culture. It speaks to an understanding of the problem at its various levels that I think we would need out of a president.
Elaine Kmark, once again, you're with the Democratic National Committee Rules Committee and have been for a long time. This goes back to the question of the format, it seems to me, and the effort that Julian Castro has made to introduce into the debate subjects that other people weren't talking about. And he really didn't get a chance to elaborate very much on that, I think partly because the other candidates didn't have much to say about it and the moderators moved on to something else. Is that another weakness of the system?
Well, I think it's a weakness of the system for sure. But the fundamental weakness of the system is that there are 10, 12, 20 candidates. That's the fundamental weakness of the system. You can't have a debate go on for 7 hours on national television. So you have to figure out how to, you know, get it down to a reasonable amount of time. I think in the future, maybe they should focus a little bit more on foreign policy in one debate and domestic policy in another debate. I worked in the White House for a long time, and I can tell you that none of the domestic issues take up nearly as much time as foreign policy does, and that Donald Trump's one of his major problems as president is his profound weakness in understanding of the rest of the world. So I would like to see the debates that more closely contoured to what the actual job is, as opposed to the infinite number of arguments that they've been having over how to expand healthcare. And I also think that they're going to have to figure out how to keep people off the stage who, in a previous era, would not be thought of as capable of being president. And that's a tough one. It goes right against the grain of what people think these should be, which is wide open. But, you know, on the one hand, people want a wide open system. And then on the other hand, they complain that there's all these people on the stage and you don't get any substance from anybody. Well, you can't have it both ways, right? You have to make some tough decisions. And I would hope that both parties, because believe me, the Republicans had the same problem 4 years ago. I would hope that both parties in the future would think a little bit carefully about how they structure their debates in presidential primaries.
Interesting. I'm just thinking that one word that none of you nor I have uttered since we began this program is impeachment, which, of course, is dominating the news at the moment. Elaine Kmark, do you think that the presidential candidates ought to talk about impeachment? Is that something that should come up? They all seem to be avoiding it like the plague.
Well, I mean, I think you did play that very powerful clip of Joe Biden's town hall, okay, where he's clearly talking about impeachment. They're not avoiding it like the plague. They all think that Donald Trump should be impeached. I mean, it goes to the issues that we've been talking about. These debates tend to the moderators and the participants tend to want to focus on points of disagreement, not agreement. And it's too bad because, in fact, I think that between Amy Klobuchar and Kamala Harris, who's a very two very powerful prosecutors, Joe Biden with all of his experience, I think that they could use these debates to help Americans understand just how serious President Trump's infractions of the Constitution are. But instead, what they all agree on that. So because they all agree on it, neither they nor the moderators spend any time on it, and they spend an inordinate amount of time on health care. So I think that it's in the nature of the beast that you spend time on the things that you disagree with, and that really hasn't been working. I think, as we've all pointed out, that hasn't been working to the benefit of the voters.
Patrick Stewart, you indicated at the outset that perhaps there ought to be a reconsideration of this whole format. One suggestion that was just made was let's have topics for given debates on a particular subject. So at least you could go into detail on something. And foreign policy, of course, it's a massive subject in and of itself. But you could focus on it, and that would definitely raise different issues than we've been hearing. What other ideas do you have? What would be, I don't know if there's any perfect format, but what are some good ideas for changing it?
I don't know if they're good ideas, but I think one of the things that we consider is that we have brackets of debates where individuals debate each other. It's something that we do in sports, and we might consider that. We might also consider, oddly enough, that the various different game shows and reality TV shows engage their participants in trials and tribulations. And oftentimes that might be more revealing, especially if you're under the camera's eye for 24 hours like a Big Brother and you're trying to make a difference in a small town with other candidates. That might be fascinating and would be good TV, and it would show us just what the candidates are about in their unguarded time. So there's a lot of things that we can do, but what's feasible? I don't know. I really don't know. And that's the challenge of a big democracy, is that evolutionarily, we would know the people that we put into leadership positions. But now we have to make our decisions based upon what we see on TV. And that's not necessarily the truth, as we found out.
Aren't you advocating essentially another kind of reality TV?
Yes. Yes. If we're going to do reality TV, let's at least try to make it more like what political leaders should be doing, which is actually governing, as opposed to just debating each other, which is about asserting intellectual dominance and making yourself more likable.
Okay, this says a lot about the era in which we live, the dominance of communications technology on everything, certainly including politics. It's been great to talk with all of you. Patrick Stewart, once again, is associate professor at the University of Arkansas, author of Debatable Humor, Laughing Matters on the 2008 Presidential Primary Campaign. Elaine Kramark is with the Brookings Institution. She's at the Kennedy School of Government, and she's been a member of the Rules Committee of the Democratic National Committee since 1997. Jamil Smith is a senior writer at Rolling Stone. Jenna Johnson is national political correspondent for the Washington Post. Great to have you all. Thank you so much. We'll see what happens next.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Hey, that was terrific. That was a lot of fun. Much appreciate all you doing it. And we'll all be watching with interest tomorrow night.
Almost certainly. Can I go ahead and maybe go a sidebar? And Jamil, can I ask you a question?
Yeah, by all means.
Okay, you were talking about Kamala Harris. And one of the things I noted with the first debate is that she seemed to be very relaxed. And she smiled a lot, she laughed a lot, and she was just very likable that first debate. And of course, she had that moment with Joe Biden, which said, there's some steel, but it's a likable person. Mm-hmm. It seemed later on that she was kind of tensing up because she had to meet those standards. Is that something that you're reading as well or seeing as well from her? And the rest of you, are you seeing that? Or is that just something that I'm interpreting and maybe misinterpreting?
Well, I can tell you from when I interviewed her, she definitely got more comfortable, I would say, when she was able to talk about things that were, you know, I guess related to, you know, her, not just herself, but just things that she related to personally. And okay. So, you know, for everything from, you know, giving me a recipe to, you know, talking about her background in San Francisco politics. You know, she just, you know, was breathing easier. I definitely noticed that. And I think that if she had more of an opportunity in these debates to really get into, you know, say her prosecutorial record in ways that were actually nuanced rather than having to, you know, defend against that, you know, that hit of a question from or that get comment from Tulsi Gabbard that one debate.
Yeah,
I think that we'd have a real honest conversation about, you know, jurisprudence and why she feels that stance, why she feels that her background is best suited for the presidency. But unfortunately, I don't think they're being asked the right questions. They're just being asked questions on policy, and they're not being asked questions about who they are.
Okay.
I would love to hear questions about that.
Yeah, that's one of the things that some of my colleagues are doing research, and they suggest that there's leadership niches, that people create their niches, and the successful leaders are the ones who are able to say, this is the problem, and I'm the solution. And it seems like that's a challenge when leadership niches are being created for individuals, especially through debates, which I'm not sure where we go. I mean, certainly since at least Kennedy, it's been about the telegenic ones as opposed to the successful politicos. So
yeah, and I thought that Kamala Harris has the toughest case to make of any candidate, not just because she's a black woman running for president. She's a black woman who has been a prosecutor, who is telling an increasingly black electorate that I will work within the system to change the system, and I need you to trust me to do that. That's a hell of an ask. And I think, frankly, it might be too big of an ask.
She takes a lot of heat, though, for her failure as a attorney general to do more with regard to prison reform in particular and some of the very, I think, discriminatory laws we have in California due to the war on drugs.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think also she, you know, she's tried to play up some of the, you know, positive and progressive things that she did with regards to that. And I think too often they get lost in the sauce and in this reductive thinking of the Kamala is a cop thing, and we just end up going nowhere. And I think to a large degree, it's not necessarily her to blame for that. I think we need to look at ourselves.
As Elaine Kmark says, there's something wrong with everybody.
Yeah. Amen to that.
That was a great line, Elaine.
Oh, not any of us, though.
Yep.
Producer of today's podcast is Andrea Brody, with audio assistance from PJ Shahamat. Our engineer is Chuck Prebateri. You can get other episodes on your favorite podcasting app. And you can contact us or reach out and message us on social media, Twitter, Facebook. We're at tothepoint_KCRW, or you can tweet me at WarrenAlney1. Thanks so much, and join us again. Great to have you this time.